also have an important announcement, and I'll actually also send an email about this later on. I'm announcing an addition, of course, to our perfect attendance award. This is a contest announcement. I do this from time to time. This is called the Justice Douglas Zone of Privacy Art Competition. And it relates to a case that we'll get to soon, Griswold versus Connecticut. And an important aspect of Justice Douglas's opinion in that case, which is kind of summarized in a sentence in his decision, in which he says, specific guarantees in the Bill of Rights have penumbra formed by emanations from those guarantees that help give them life and substance. Various guarantees create zones of privacy. And this is by way of explaining how come there is this fundamental zone of privacy that will wind up invalidating Connecticut's restriction on the use of contraceptives. Over the years, I've done this, and people have come up with very clever ways to demonstrate or illustrate this concept of penumbras and emanations and zones of privacy. Any medium, any size, 8.5 by 11 or larger, pencil, pen and ink, colors of any kind, any form. Some people, of course, who don't draw very well have made use of illustrations they found online, which they've cleverly inserted in some conceptual framework. Other people who draw very well have sometimes done quite spectacular jobs that demonstrate high-level artwork. These are going to be due on Tuesday before class. I assume we'll be talking about Griswold at that point. So, short window of opportunity to hand them in, and a prize for the winning artist. I'm the sole judge. It's a completely subjective standard. And the contest can only happen if there are at least three entries. Think about participating. On Wednesday, I'll bring in some of my favorite from past contests. Save them. In the last class, we were discussing Lochner versus New York, and we're going to return to that subject. We had identified the three justifications that the state of New York seems to have offered for the statute that they enacted, their maximum hour law statute as applied to bakery workers. We were about to talk about, and we'll start now, by talking about the court's treatment of each of these justifications. And let's start with the healthy bread justification. Is it important for New York to guarantee that its citizens have healthy bread? Is that an important objective within the meaning of the police power? What do you think?
Is that important or insignificant as a goal?
Yes, I think it's important.
It's important. Right, it's a staple of a diet. So we've seen a lot of milk cases. This one finally gets us a bread case. It's an important objective. So if that's true, why doesn't the court accept this justification as a sufficient basis to justify the statute here? What's wrong?
They say that it's not possible to discover the connection between the number of hours of labor works and the helpful quality of bread.
It's not possible. In whose view?
In our judgment.
So that means the court's own view. Was it possible in the view of the legislature to see a connection?
Yes, it was.
Sure, otherwise they wouldn't have enacted the statute. But this court says, who cares what they think, right?
it's a question of what our judgment is about whether there's a connection, a sufficient connection between the two. Now, earlier we had talked about the fact that the standard was, at least as announced early on in the opinion on the first full paragraph on 380, was this fair, reasonable, and appropriate versus unreasonable, unnecessary, and arbitrary. What's the connection between those conclusions that the law, for instance, is arbitrary or unreasonable versus reasonable? What's the connection between that and this discussion? That New York says, well, our objective is healthy bread, and the court says, well, we don't think that there's any connection between this law and healthy bread. How do those two somehow or other fold into each other?
Well, the court says that the fact they're making it 10 hours, the cutoff line, is arbitrary, because they say, well, what about 10 and a half or 11? Like, how do they just come up upon this number of hours? It's 10, that's arbitrary and unreasonable.
Well, what if it were 20 hours? Would the court say the same thing? How about 24 hours? You can't make someone work more than 24 hours in one day. Would that be arbitrary?
Would that be impossible?
Well, I mean, 20, well, okay. What if we make it 23 hours and 59 minutes? I mean, is that arbitrary? Is it arbitrary just because of the particular, I mean, my question really is it arbitrary because of the particular cutoff they chose, that it's not enough hours, or is it arbitrary for some other reason? What makes it arbitrary?
They said that the act has to have a more direct relation, that it doesn't achieve the end that the...
Okay, it has to have a more direct relation between what and what? What's the phrase the court uses? Because this is really where sort of the heart of due process lies for us. A more direct relation between what and what? I mean, the concept of a direct relation suggests that we're talking about the relationship between two things, and they have to be more related. So between what and what?
As to the means and the end.
More direct relationship between the means and the end in order to avoid being arbitrary, I mean, or unreasonable, right? That's really the connection. The court says the reasonableness of the law has to be evaluated in terms of the extent of the connection that exists between the means and the ends. So let's get back to healthy bread. What's the problem with a maximum hour law, the means, and the ends of healthy bread?
Means don't necessarily ensure healthier bread.
Because healthy bread is not a product of how long workers have worked. Okay, so the court says no causal connection between how long a worker has worked and the production of healthy bread. Well, is that true? I mean, what do you think? The court says we don't think in our judgment there's a connection. Could there arguably be a connection? What might happen when a worker works longer that would produce a less healthy bread supply? Anything?
Sanitary issues.
Sanitary issues, okay.
Making mistakes while they're processing wheat or grain, not washing their hands after working 10 hours straight.
Okay,
like that.
So workers could get sloppy in their work, sanitary conditions. Maybe they, you know, they're going for the salt and instead they take down some kind of poisonous chemical that happens to be around the bakery to get rid of rats. Sloppiness because you're too tired to really focus, right? That could be what the legislature would see as the link. But does the court care about that? Any discussion about the possible relationships that could exist between limiting hours of work and ensuring healthy bread? Or just kind of the court's judgment, no connection, or not enough of a connection, no direct connection? Is that what this really amounts to? Is there anything the legislature could have done to convince the court that their concept of relatedness between the means and the ends was direct enough? Or was the kind of the handwriting on the wall before this case ever got to this stage? What do you think?
Might have helped their case if they had done a study or provided some evidence to show that this was the case instead
okay.
of stating that it was.
So if they could kind of study comparing the experience in two bakeries, one where the workers worked a short shift and one with a long shift, and they can show that there were problems with the bread produced, maybe then the court might have been interested, but they didn't have any study. They just had a sort of the, you know, the logic of the fact that at a certain point in the workday, that a person's concentration, ability to perform the task is impaired. The court clearly doesn't want to accept that. Okay, what about the issue of whether it could be justified as a labor law? After all, the court says, we talked about this last time, the legislature concludes that bakery workers and presumably other hourly employees just don't have any bargaining power. They don't want to work more than 60 hours a week, but they're forced to because the employers hold all the cards in the deck and can tell them, you know, kind of take it or leave it, 70 hours, or we'll find someone else to do the job. What about that justification for the law, that really this law was lobbied for heavily by supporters of the bakery workers? Because this is really what the bakery workers wanted, but they couldn't get it on their own because their employers were simply held, had too much power in the bargaining relationship. There's an imbalance of power, and we need this to help us out. We don't want to work more than this, but we're being forced to. What happens to that justification? What's the court say every time they talk about this as potentially as a labor law?
You say there's no reasonable ground for interfering with the liberty of a person or the right for free contract?
No reasonable ground for interfering with the ability of the employer and employee to come to a bargain free of any government regulation. That there shouldn't be any regulation, that they should just be able to contract with anything they want. And if one party has more power in the negotiation, so be it. That is the natural order of things and kind of a survival of the fittest, and the legislature has no business interfering with that. Why not? Why isn't it reasonable for the legislature to say, well, that may be the natural order of things, but there's nothing in the Constitution which prevents us from deciding that that relationship is not good for the public interest? That the country would be better off if these sort of powerful interests were constrained to some degree. And that's a sort of an objective that's legitimate under the police power for the public welfare. How come the court can just say, sorry, we don't think you ought to be able to do that? Why?
Don't they say that it would stop people who wanted to work that many hours, that it would prevent them from doing so?
It does, but that's based on a dubious conclusion that there are all these people dying to work more than 60 hours a week in the conditions of a bakery, right? I mean, we don't really know there's a single one of those folks, and the court doesn't know it either, do they? I mean, they didn't do a study. They didn't survey the workforce to find out how many of Lochner's employees are dying to work more than 60 hours a week. So they're just making it up, right? Just like they say the legislature's making it up, they're making it up too. But why? What's really going on here? Why this level of hostility?
Well, I was going to say they imply it into the Constitution that there is freedom of contract.
They imply how much protection for freedom of contract would you say this case suggests? A little or a lot?
A lot.
A lot of protection. Yeah, it's become a kind of a fundamental constitutional value that the state is not free to interfere with, even if they have a really good reason for it, not free to interfere with this. Indeed, if you look at how the court describes this statute right after that sentence about this is an illegal interference in the middle of 381, with the rights of individuals, both employers and employees, to make contracts regarding labor upon such terms as they may think best. The court at one point talks about statutes of the nature of that under review, limiting the hours in which grown and intelligent men may labor to earn their living, are meddlesome interferences with the rights of the individuals. Pretty clear where they stand. Meddlesome interferences with the rights of the individuals. What do you think this court would do if it were confronted with the individual mandate provision in the new health care law? What would they do?
You strike it down.
Strike it down. Strike it down, not under the Commerce Clause, right? But strike it down under the Due Process Clause as an interference with individual liberty. People ought to be able to decide whether they want to buy health insurance or not. The state has no right to interfere with that decision, right? So this kind of puts a very, very high value on sort of individual autonomy in making at least this case is about, making commercial decisions, right? That's what this category of decision is. This is a commercial decision. And presumably whether to spend money on health insurance, also a commercial or an economic decision, right? The court says the state can't prevent people from making the kinds of economic decisions that they want to make. They should be free to make those decisions without interference, meddlesome interference. Okay, so labor laws, and this commentary about labor laws, is this just mean this law is this labor law is unconstitutional? What if we had a minimum wage law? What would happen to it?
Struck down.
Struck down. What if it's a maximum hour law, but it's sort of provides for more hours of employment? Upheld or struck down?
Struck down.
Struck down, yeah. Labor laws, terrible. Legislature can't do that. So in that here, remember, this is all about sort of looking at the ends-means relationship. When it came to healthy bread, was there a suitable end or not?
Well, yeah, healthy bread was a suitable end.
Healthy bread is a suitable end, but the problem was the means and the relationship between the means and the end of healthy bread. What about when it comes to the labor law? What's the problem? Is it a suitable end to redress bargaining imbalance?
Not according to this court.
Not according to this court. Not a suitable end. We don't even get to the means. The end is simply illegitimate. Okay, so let's get to healthy bakers, which is the one justification the court takes a little more seriously here. So is a concern about the health of bakers a legitimate end? What do you think? Or think that's is that legitimate? Is it like a labor being enacting a labor law? Is it like a healthy bread law? Which is it closer to in terms of a justification?
Well,
Closer to healthy bread, healthy bakers. And does the court think that this law has any kind of relationship to achieving that objective? Is there a good means-ends relationship between the health of bakers and the hours that bakers work? What do you think? Any connection? Yeah, bakers are just as healthy as anybody else. Now, is that a universally shared view? Does everyone agree with that? I don't mean in the class, I mean at the time of this case. Is that a universally held view?
No, the dissent disagreed because they were uncomfortable.
The dissent disagreed, and what did it base that disagreement on in Justice Harlan's opinion? How does Justice Harlan know that being a bakery worker is almost as unhealthy as being a coal miner? How does he know that?
Is it a treatise by Professor Hurt on the disease of the workers?
Yeah, and how do you think he knows that, let's assume he's not an expert in bakery workers' health. How do you think he knows about Professor Hurt's treatise?
Maybe the legislator offered it as justification?
Maybe. Or who else offers arguments to judges?
The laborers.
No, the laborers, do they come directly to the court and make arguments?
Their representation.
They're lawyers! You! Their lawyers make arguments about why this is a reasonable objective and undoubtedly cited in their brief the existence of all of this scientific evidence that suggests that the New York legislature knew what it was talking about. Even if New York hadn't looked at this, this stuff is still out there and it proves the point, says Justice Harlan, that there is legitimacy to the concerns of New York. And it turns out not to be only Professor Hurt. I mean, he writes one article, but then the court also, and Justice Harlan says, another writer says the constant inhaling of flour dust causes inflammation of the lungs and the bronchial tubes. The eyes suffer through this dust, cramps, swollen legs. I mean, it sounds terrible, right? No one's going to work in a bakery after reading this. In any event, so he says, look, this isn't an illegitimate concern. Bakery workers are subjected to health conditions that put their health at risk, particularly as they work longer and longer hours without relief. So how come the majority gets to ignore all that? How come they get to ignore all that?
They're members of a different economic class?
Because they're members of a different economic class, and they don't really take seriously these complaints about bakery workers. And because, related to this, it doesn't matter what anybody else says, all that matters is, what did you say before?
Their judgment.
Their judgment. All that matters is their judgment, what they think, not what anybody else thinks, right? They're reviewing this. Are they reviewing this just like they were the legislature itself, essentially making this decision about whether this is a good law or a bad law? I mean, is that what this amounts to? As opposed to, is there any deference to the judgment of the legislature in this opinion? No deference, right? It doesn't matter what New York might have believed. It doesn't matter what scientists have said. They don't think there's a sufficient relationship between the means and the ends here because bakery workers aren't in any special need of protection. Now, would this court say that no workers are in need of protection? Would it matter if some other category of workers was being regulated? Suppose it was workers at a nuclear power plant.
where it's very strenuous and inherently dangerous.
Okay, so the court does recognize that some of the time the state can step in when we're talking about an inherently dangerous occupation. They just don't happen to consider bakery workers to be an inherently dangerous occupation. And they tell us if they allow the regulation of the hours of bakery workers, what else will they eventually be forced to allow? Yeah, everybody, all workers have, you know, unhealthy conditions to some extent. Next thing you know, every worker, including lawyers and doctors, will get minimum wage, will get maximum hour legislation. And that would surely be unacceptable. So they say, once we open the door, this is what we normally refer to in terms of the form of argumentation as a slippery slope argument. Which crops up a lot in constitutional law and other places, that once the court, if the court were to uphold this law, then they would kind of be forced by the logic of that decision to then go down this path or this slippery slope to uphold all other hour restrictions that apply to every other category of worker, because there'd be no reasonable way to distinguish between bakery workers and any other worker, factory workers or school teachers or lawyers or doctors. Now, maybe that's not true, but that's an argument they give for the need for line drawing. We have to draw this line somewhere, or the next thing you know, our restrictions would be constitutional. Now, does that mean the court is telling us that there's nothing the state of New York could do to help the health of bakery workers? Are they powerless to worry about bakery workers and their health as a result of this decision? Or does the court suggest that there are some opportunities here for the legislature? What do you think? Is there anything in the case which tells us one way or the other what the answer to that question is?
Like health laws?
Okay.
Instead of labor laws?
Well, for example, what? Do we know exactly what? Or do we have any indication of what that might be?
They talk about they provide for inspections.
Where do they provide for inspections?
On the premises with the bakeries.
No. Where is such a thing provided for?
Oh, in the other sections.
It turns out this statute that New York enacted had more than one provision. It just didn't have a restriction on the hours of employment. It had then a series of sections which dealt with other aspects of conditions in bakeries, including, as we learn in 381, sections of the Act which provide for the inspection of the premises where the bakery is carried on. Which provide with regard to furnishing proper washrooms and water closets, also with regard to providing proper drainage. So there has to be a bathroom and a sink appropriately available so those bakery workers can keep sanitary. The conditions can be inspected to make sure that there are no significant health risks, those rats running around, for instance. They can make sure there's proper drainage, plumbing, and painting, and for other things of that nature. So are these restrictions going to be burdensome in terms of the employer, these other sections of the statute? Are they going to cost the employer money? Well, why can the court do? Why does the court say it's okay to do them, but not the maximum hour law? why these kinds of techniques of protecting the health of bakery workers, sanitation related, plumbing related.
And the court suggests those are reasonable means to the end to help the workers.
Those are reasonable means to the end. Well, why are they reasonable, but the hour restriction is unreasonable? That's really the critical question here. Why are one kind of law reasonable and the other kind of law unreasonable?
From the court's perspective, they're not interfering with the freedom of contract between employer and employee.
Ah, those other restrictions, do the other restrictions limit liberty?
Which restrictions?
The sanitary restrictions. Do they limit liberty?
Oh, well, yes.
Yes, they do. If you're a bakery owner, right? Suddenly you got to spend more money on plumbing and sanitation and painting your place. Hey, maybe you don't want it to be painted or sanitary or any of those other things, or have good drainage or good plumbing. Shouldn't you have freedom to construct your bakery operation any way you want? Right? It's liberty, but somehow or other, this intrusion on liberty, the court seems more willing to tolerate than the maximum hour law. Is that, I mean, is it because it's not an intrusion on liberty of contract in the same way, the bargaining relationship between employer and employee, that somehow that's a more protected liberty than the liberty to operate an unsanitary bakery operation? I mean, why that difference of opinion by the court? Are the restrictions on sanitary conditions, et cetera, do you think that they're more likely to protect the health of bakery workers than the maximum hour law?
They're more directly related to the health of the workers.
They're more directly related to the health of the workers. And I take it that that was the point the court made about the healthy bread. We want a direct relationship. So the court says they have to be directly related. And then it's okay. At least if it's not a labor law. Well, if there's no direct relationship, does that make the law unreasonable? Which was the original test the court announced. Is it unreasonable to take an indirect route as compared to a direct route? Let's say we're driving on the road, we can take a direct route, we get there quicker, or we'll take the scenic route. Still direct, it's still gonna get us there. So is it unreasonable to use indirect means? What do you think? Is the court narrowing the choice of means that the legislature has available to it? Is that what this case essentially stands for? That they don't get free choice, that the court's going to kind of pick and choose the ones that it thinks are the most direct?
Well, it seems like they almost don't believe that the legislature is actually enacting this legislation for those motives that they described.
Yeah, they're afraid that it may be really a labor law. And that would be terrible. But what about at the end? I remember we started the opinion with the language on 380. Is it fair? Is this a fair, reasonable, appropriate exercise of the police power? Is unreasonable, unnecessary? And we end with a statement, it's manifest to us that the law here has no such direct relation to and no such substantial effect upon the health of the employee as to justify us in regarding the section as really a health law. That's the point that you made. So is that a different test? Or is it the same test? This concept that somehow or other there has to be this more direct relation between means and ends. One, we're talking about the law simply being reasonable, not arbitrary. And the other, we're talking about the law accomplishing its ends by direct means. And those the same thing? Or is the court kind of switched the standard on us to make it harder for New York to win? What do you think? In what cases have we ever seen the court concerned with other ways that an objective could be accomplished?
Dorman-Commerce
Clause. Which test?
The
strict
test.
The strict test. We look at other means. Anywhere else? Other means? Any place else we've seen that? Looking at other ways it could be done? What about the California prison case? Courts say you could do it other ways. Non-discriminatory ways? They did. They talked about other means. In the privileges and immunities case, the court looked at other means as a way of deciding whether these means were substantially related or not. Interestingly, every single time we've seen the court look at other means, it has been in the context of some more rigorous standard of review, one that is not completely deferential to the state. Is that what we're looking at here? A means that's not a test that's not deferential to the government? And I take it we've said that all along. There's no deference here. They don't care what the state thinks. It's only what they think, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of what happens in Lochner. And of course, there's the dissenting opinion by Harlan saying that there's a good enough reason for this, and it doesn't matter whether he thinks it's a good law. That's not really the question. It's whether the legislature could have concluded that. And what does Justice Holmes add to the mix? What's he angry about? What aspect of this opinion? What does he think the court did wrong? They decided on an economic basis, and that's, and we know that because what did they say the court can't do? The legislature can't do?
To restrict the freedom of contract.
Restrict freedom of contract, but I mean, Justice Holmes's opinion is a response to what piece of this? Is it about the analysis of whether there's a sufficient relationship between healthy bread and the law? Whether it's there's a sufficient relationship between healthy bakers and the law, or the discussion of its inappropriateness as a labor law? Which of those three is he responding to?
The labor law.
The labor law analysis, that's right. He says the Constitution doesn't say that the relationship between employer and employee has to be unrestrained by the legislature. That's a particular economic theory, laissez-faire, economic theory, but there's nothing in the Constitution which requires that that theory be the operative theory upon which the legislature operates. The legislature can choose a different theory of the relationship between employee and employer, one in which it's legitimate for the state to come in and correct bargaining imbalances. So he's angry about this. In his view, Justice Harlan is angry about the degree of relationship that the court seems to think is necessary, their willingness to substitute their own judgment for the judgment of the New York legislature. Okay. Let's take a look at the additional case, just as another example of what happens in this kind of case, Weaver. One of the great old cases. Weaver is the case involving the New York, the Pennsylvania legislature's regulations of the fillings of various mattresses, pillows, quilts, etc., the internals of these things. And under the Pennsylvania statute,
Suppose you wanted to, you were a manufacturer of pillows, and you wanted to use as a filling secondhand material. So you bought up secondhand clothing, you chopped it up, and you wanted to use it as a filling for you, or you bought secondhand quilts or secondhand pillows, and you wanted to reuse them. Would you be allowed to do so? Secondhand material. Could you use it?
You could use it according to the statute as long as it was sterilized and disinfected.
Okay, so if you agree to sterilize or disinfect it, you can use it. Suppose, by contrast, you wanted to fill your pillows with this material that's called shoddy. Suppose you disinfected it. Could you use it?
No.
No. So there's an absolute ban on the use of shoddy, whereas there's whereas it's permissible to use to use secondhand materials as long as they are sanitized, sterilized, or disinfected. Now, what's the theory behind this different treatment? I mean, we know that shoddy is basically scraps of fabric that fall on the floor as other kinds of things are being manufactured. So you have these sort of leftover scraps, so you have a factory in which they're making clothing or bedding or whatever it is, and they're cutting it to the pattern, and there's a whole bunch of waste scraps, it winds up on the floor, it's swept up, bagged up, and sold to manufacturers of pillows and other kinds of bedding materials. So why did Pennsylvania think they had to absolutely ban shoddy? What was the objective behind this statute, behind this part of the statute? What's Pennsylvania trying to accomplish?
That shoddy is like exposed to all this bacteria and it's sitting around on the floor, so it's just no matter if you sterilize or what, it's just this awful material.
Okay, so it's unhealthy, right? It's another health law. The court strikes it down, the question is why? Does the court think that banning shoddy will not protect consumers? The health of consumers? Do they dispute that it, in fact, will accomplish the legislative objective of protecting the health of consumers if this stuff is banned entirely?
Well, they say it's not a legitimate end. It's once you sterilize it or do.
Well, is it not a legitimate end or is it not a legitimate means?
Not legitimate means.
Ah, the end is okay. Healthy pillows is a legitimate end, but the means is not legitimate. Now, why? Will it accomplish the objective?
Yes.
Do you have to do something to regulate shoddy?
Yes.
Yes. So the court concedes that you need to regulate shoddy. You just can't use it with unrestricted. And indeed, they uphold the restrictions that apply to secondhand materials that require sterilization and disinfection. People aren't allowed to use those just wherever they find them. They have to treat them in an appropriate way. Well, this statute, will it be equally effective as the disinfection, the requirement that it be sanitized?
Well, it's going to be effective. But
it's going to be effective. Well, if it's going to be effective, right, why not let the legislature do it? It's solving a real problem, and it's going to work. Why can't they choose it? What's the reason?
I'd say that there's a high demand for it. It's a question of public concern.
People want it.
People want it. It's probably cheaper.
It is cheaper. It is cheaper. And poor people are going to buy it. Not rich people, but poor people are going to buy it. So does that mean that
we're talking about the liberty of someone to buy anything they want?
We're talking about inherently dangerous. Well, is not inherently dangerous.
Well, isn't it inherently dangerous if left untreated?
If left untreated.
If left untreated, but why can't they just go further? Why do they have to settle for just requiring disinfection? It'd be sanitized. Why can't they go further and use a means that's even more foolproof? You can't use it at all. More foolproof, right? No one's ever going to get injured or sick from shoddy filled comfortables.
The scientific studies eliminated the concern.
Concern only if. Oh, yeah, all right. So all they're saying is you don't need to go this far. So now suddenly the government can come in and say the legislature has a good objective and they have chosen an effective means of accomplishing that objective, but the problem here is there's an alternative. They don't need to go this far. There's a lesser form of regulation that would accomplish the same objective. That's what this case says. There's a lesser form of objective, right? As Alex says, they don't need to go this far. And that's what the court is saying here. They could do this another way that gave more latitude to the Palmer Brothers Company, didn't take away as much of their freedom. Is there any reason to think that the requirement of sterilization is going to be not as easy to enforce as a total ban? How are you going to enforce the requirement of sterilization?
You have to inspect the stuff to make sure it's sterilized.
You have to inspect it. Visual inspection good enough? Will it look different after it's sterilized?
Well,
does it? That's right. It's not going to look any different. It's not really going to look different. Visual inspection isn't enough. You have to subject it to some kind of scientific test to determine if it's been sterilized. Could the legislature think that they don't want to go to the trouble, that it's going to cost them more money, going to cost the taxpayers of Pennsylvania more money, and that this is a kind of a more effective, more, we don't need a whole this is the kind of regulation where suddenly we're going to have mattress inspectors going out all over the place, sampling shoddy filled mattresses and seeing whether they're sterilized or not. Can't the legislature think it'll be a lot easier if they could administer this by visual inspection as opposed to more elaborate forms of inspection?
Well, the Act says that the secondhand material that they're not banning has to be inspected. So they say since they're doing that anyway, they can do it for shoddy too.
Okay. So
the court is again examining the need to do it this way. And that's really the heart of this. Is there really any need to do it this way? Couldn't you do it some lesser way and still have it be effective? That's really what the Lochner era, now gone, and part of this is, there's another piece of this I forgot to mention. In addition to a requirement of sterilization and it should be sterilized and disinfected, what's the other thing that the court says it would be okay for the state to do? And it has something to do with this little tag. Or shoddy, filled with shoddy. And if it does say that, what's the benefit of that? Put a label on it, and therefore, people who buy it, buyer beware. Yeah, want to take a chance? Buy a cheap pillow that's filled with shoddy? You know, there's at least a risk. You don't want to run that risk. Buy a product filled with something else. Now, you know, that's a problem if you can't afford more than a shoddy-filled pillow, but the court's not really worried about but folks who can't afford more more high-end bedding. Okay, so next time we're going to start with the cases that in which Lochner disappears quickly, starting with Nebbia, and then we'll look at Caroline Products and Williamson versus Lee Optical as examples of the retreat from this kind of scrutiny, where suddenly the court is going to give deference to the legislature and is not going to micromanage the choice of means. And we're going to see the contrast. I said there's a chart on the website that can show you what this changeover looks like. And after we look at those cases, we'll go on to Griswold versus Connecticut and the first of the cases involving personal liberties as compared to economic liberties.